So I have four nieces and nephews, and I was talking to my sister about IXL. And IXL Learning is this fun online program for kids, and it covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. My sister and my nephew love it. The way it works is it's powered by AI, so IXL gives the right help to each kid. And IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Maybe you've been looking into private tutoring, but it's out of the budget, or this is a big school year for your kiddo. So make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Ologies listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/ologies. So visit IXL.com/ologies to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at Fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE, SIPC.
Oh, hey, it's your old uncle who's pretty dubious of that fat-free salad dressing. Allie Ward. Back with another episode of Ologies. So before you think, wait, did I hear this one already? Is this just a revisiting of Lepidopterology with butterfly expert Phil Torres, who also professionally plays with baby dogs on his new CW television show, Ready, Set, Pet? Nope. It's a different episode. Different Phil Torres. It's a different Phil Torres. Boy, howdy. You know, in the 60 plus episodes that we have journeyed through together, friends, we have gone face first into death and tumors and misogyny, pet euthanasia, dabbled into crow funerals. But I gotta say, this one, wow, this one's gonna have you just staring into the mirror at 1 a.m. asking, the fuck, Ward? Maybe more than any of them. This one is the apocalypse. Are you ready? No? Okay, I'm gonna stall for 1 second. Before the existential upheaval, just a quick thanks to everyone supporting via patreon.com/ologies, anyone who has put merch on your bod from ologiesmerch.com, and all the folks who for $0 rate, make the commitment to hit subscribe, who leave a review, which I creep with joy, and I highlight one each week. This week, you know what? I'm going to do two. One's quick. Shout out to Tara in Maine, who is a self-proclaimed former podcast hater and now an ologite. Come be one with us. And also, thank you for the timely as hell review from Seattle Me 227, who says, I especially love the takes on dark topics like death and fear. So refreshing. I'm an instant fan. Well, wow. Seattle Me 227, buckle up. We're talking about doomsday. So, eschatology comes from the Greek for last, meaning it's the study of the end of the world. So, as this ologist explains, this term is no longer bound to just religious contexts, but also scientific study. So, he is a neuroscientist, philosophy scholar, and author of 3 books, including The End, What Science and Religion Tell Us About the Apocalypse, and his latest release, Morality, Foresight, and Human Flourishing, An Introduction to Existential Risks. As you'll hear, the apocalypse and this episode were both a long time in the making, and I coerced this ologist to drive a few hours and meet me in an airport hotel in Philly, and he was so generous with his time, he pretty much spent the evening being lobbed questions, just barraged like asteroids, one after the other. And you'll hear about his background that led him to this branch of philosophy, and where we're at on the old doomsday clock, whether or not any of us should have babies, if we should bother recycling, why voting matters, looking at you, America, and some pop cultural antichrists, artificial intelligence, simulations, Black Mirror, technology as friend or foe, and how he's just a pretty chill guy anyway. So pack up your bug out bag and put a down payment on a bunker while you enjoy the brilliant brain of eschatologist Phil Torres.
Stepped on my glasses. Oh, so I'm driving at night, like it's just blurred.
You don't even need an apocalypse. You're your own nightmare.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Here, this is yours.
Okay, so let's start off, number one, by saying that I have been Twitter stalking you for a year. Uh-huh. No response from you. And yeah. I was like, wow, that Phil Torres guy, pretty busy.
Yeah.
Pretty important guy.
Yeah, it's pretty important.
So many times I was like, hey, I'd love for you to be on the... No, okay.
Yeah, I don't
I
know
emailed
how I...
emailed you also.
Hmm.
No, I'm not trying to put you on blast. I'm just saying that this is a very big get for me.
Yeah.
This is of no fault of your own. I was just very eagerly like, hi, it's me again.
Well, thank you. And when I finally saw the tweet that I responded to, mm-hmm. I responded to it very eagerly.
I was like, these apocalypse people are very aloof. The apocalypse scene is like the most aloof of all of them. Little did I know you were eager.
Yeah.
And also, you are the second Phil Torres I've had on the podcast.
Yeah.
How often do you, someone who studies theories about the end of the world, get confused with someone who studies butterflies and has a show about puppies?
I'm more, I feel kind of bad for the emails that he might receive, because he studies butterflies and, you know, that's pretty awesome and pretty fun. And there's a lightheartedness to it, whereas there's a darkness and a heaviness.
Oh, God.
To thinking about, say, runaway climate change or value misaligned superintelligence. So.
Oh my God. Okay, let's dive into what your ology is.
It's yes.
Eschatology? Eschatology. How do we say it?
It's a good question. There's actually debate right now.
Okay.
Whether the idea of secular apocalyptic scenarios should constitute its own field, or rather, whether it should just be a topic that is discussed by people, experts in their various areas of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the term, the semantics of the term, have evolved over time. And at this point, like, yeah, there's a sense in which it's kind of the topic that I'm interested in is kind of scientific eschatology. Yeah, thinking about the end of the world from, once again, like an evidence based, you know, empirical perspective,
as opposed to a poof, you're dead, which is would be more like being smote by Zeus or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah.
Which we in this way, we are our own angry God.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, myths of, you know, Greek myths of humans who gained too much power and, you know, it didn't turn out so well. I mean, the central concept is that of existential risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that is cheerfully defined as any event that would either cause human extinction or result in irreversible decline of our potential for desirable future development.
So in this case, the end of the planet as we know it, or the end of our species, the great berbye. Also, this subject matter is so, so dark and surreal that I just could not stop laughing at the absurd awfulness of it. I'm so sorry. I don't know why this is so far the most hilarious episode. It's just so terrible. It's like kind of funny.
I was at a conference a while back and with a bunch of people who publish on this topic. And we had a really good time. It was a lot of fun. There was a lot of laughter and joyousness.
Oh God.
And at some point we sort of conjectured that there must be a self-selection process. You know, if you were like lugubrious by disposition a certain amount.
P.S. The word lugubrious means sad and mournful, and I'm not too proud to admit that I just had to look it up.
Then you just don't end up, you know, living, you know, and breathing these issues all the time.
We need balance.
Yeah.
Because how can we appreciate a butterfly if we don't appreciate the fact that the butterfly could maybe just combust spontaneously into fire along with everyone that you love?
In fact, I've sometimes mentioned, you know, a kind of paradox of the field, which is that I think it is among the most important topics that anybody could be talking about or thinking about researching, publishing on.
Well, I mean, the crux of what you do is how can we appreciate our existence if we don't examine the possibility of it ending? Mm-hmm. Right?
That is
sort of,
that is an implication. Yeah. So, okay. So the stuff that I do in particular is mostly trying to understand the nature of the biggest global scale kind of disaster scenarios facing humanity this century for the express purpose of identifying ways to mitigate those okay. risks and make sure that they never happen.
Right. Let's go back in time to baby Phil Torres.
Okay.
At what point did your family realize you were more contemplative, perhaps, than other children?
Yeah. We're talking about me, not, yes, the, you, not the entomologist. You, okay. Okay. Got it. So it's interesting. I mean, the my interest now, there's a kind of genealogy I can trace all the way back to childhood, because I grew up in a pretty religious household.
Oh.
And...
What flavor?
Baptist.
Okay.
To use a more esoteric term, the broader view was dispensationalist.
I don't know what that means.
So that's when you hear about the rapture.
Oh, boy.
You can think dispensationalism.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is the poof, I'm gone. Uh-huh. Are my clothes and shoes still here? Mm-hmm. But my body and soul is gone. That's the rapture.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you actually look carefully at the chronology of the narrative, it's stunning. Like the rapture is supposed to happen and your soul is separated from your body. And then there's a 7-year tribulation where the Antichrist gains power in the UN or EU or something like that. Ooh. And then signs a peace treaty, initially beginning of tribulation with Israel.
Okay.
And then halfway through invades Israel. And then God rains down all of this horrible punishment. Oh. And then there's the second coming, and that's when Armageddon happens. And then there are various other things that continue to happen in the eschaton.
You grew up with these,
yes,
sort
I
of
did.
With these beliefs.
I did. I have to say it fueled some pretty freaky dreams for an 8-year-old. And I do actually have this vivid memory of being in the basement of my house when Bill Clinton, on election night, when Bill Clinton won. And it was widely agreed upon in my community that he was the Antichrist. And so I just remember being overcome with terror. Ooh. And, you know, like, this is really happening. And, you know,
I love that the Antichrist plays a saxophone.
I know.
Like, because they're going to be smooth and they're going to charm you.
Totally. It's part of the charm. Yeah. It's part of the charisma and
an early 90s sax solo. And everyone's like, well, damn. Here he is. He has arrived. Is your family still pretty religious?
Half of it is.
Okay.
Yeah. Half of it is quite religious. And the other half isn't so much, along with me, has kind of drifted away from, you know, the dogmatism and the various belief commitments that half the family has. But I do think it planted seeds of interest with respect to Christian eschatology. There was a sense of like, well, what's a grander topic than thinking about not just the death of individuals,
right,
but the species. Wow. And of course, the vast majority of species that have ever lived on the planet have gone extinct.
And there's something like 99.9% of all species that have ever lived are extinct.
That's correct, yeah.
So like fate has our number.
I mean, the odds are not favorable.
No.
And may the odds be ever in your favor.
Okay, but can humans skirt extinction like perhaps some ferns and weird birds and old-timey dead salamanders and the other 5 billion extinct species couldn't?
We are unique in that, I mean, for obvious reasons, we have a very high encephalization quotient, you know, big brains and have the capacity to modify our environment in various ways. You know, it's been said that the dinosaurs died out because they didn't have a space program. And, you know, and so we maybe can use technology to actually significantly reduce the probability of all sorts of catastrophes. But unfortunately, most of the risk these days comes from technology itself.
Oh.
And large scale human activity, you know, and climate change and global biodiversity loss. So yeah, technology is Janus faced and, you know, kind of a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm. P.S. Who was Janus? Well, first off, Let's call him the Roman god formerly pronounced Janus by me, because I never knew it was Janus. But anyway, he's the god of beginnings and transitions, and he looks to both the past and the future at the same time. Hence, January, named after this bro. But Janus-faced means that you can have characteristics that contrast or be deceitful. So it's like the scholarly way of saying that someone is a two-faced bitch. So Phil is saying technology is a two-faced bitch.
Well, at what point did you have to decide upon this as a major? So this is a sect of theology and philosophy of sorts, correct? Not correct.
I would not say theology.
Okay.
Yeah, it's naturalistic.
Okay.
You know, that actually gets at a really interesting point. For most of human history, contemplations about the end of the world were deeply intertwined with religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so there was a sense in which people kind of thought, took seriously sort of the long-term future of humanity, but that was within a theological framework according to which, you know, we have immortal souls, and, you know, at the end of the world, there's going to be a series of supernatural events. And only recently have humans started to think about the end from a secular, from a naturalistic perspective. The concept itself is really quite recent. There just isn't much that was said about human extinction, even after the end of World War II, which, of course, you know, coincided with the inauguration of the atomic age. Mm-hmm. There's still, I don't know, there wasn't that much thought about, you know, what happens if our evolutionary lineage terminates. Maybe as a result of our own actions.
But, like, we just invented soap. You know what I mean? Like, we just figured out how babies were made. You know, we're such idiots. I mean, God bless us. But, like, the idea of being like, and when shall the species be mortal? Is like, we have so much else to figure out, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, contraception is like 30 years old. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So we didn't even begin curbing the population really until recently. So, okay, getting back to school, though, at what point are you saying, Phil Torres, I am a philosophy major, this is my subset? Did you find a mentor in it? Or how do you become one of you? How do you do your life?
If that's what you want.
Yeah, exactly.
For some reason. Well, yeah, philosophy was my main subject, and then I got a master's in neuroscience. Which is somewhat related.
Yeah.
There's
it's also baller.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Master's in neuroscience.
It is. It sounds way more impressive than it actually is. I'll just to be candid.
So Phil got his bachelor's in philosophy and his master's in neuroscience. And at some point, he encountered a paper by Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom entitled Existential Risks, Analyzing Human Extinction Scenarios and Related Hazards. Now, the term existential risk means the apocalypse, just doomsday, the end. And I looked up this paper just to have a little look-see, just to do a little perusing, and I'm just going to read you the first sentence. Quote, it's dangerous to be alive, and risks are everywhere. I was like, wow, man, okay, straight out of the gate. Okay, I like that. But the next sentence was a little cheerier, saying, luckily, not all risks are equally serious. So I started skimming this paper, and I came to a header just titled Bangs, and I was like, oh man, dude, I have cut bangs, and yes, it did feel like the end of the world. And then I realized that it was just one of four categories of big death in various levels of suddenness, like bangs, crunches, shrieks, and whimpers. So this Bostrom paper includes topics such as nuclear holocaust, asteroid impact, killed by extraterrestrial civilization, and a whole category titled, quote, we're living in a simulation and it gets shut down. So just a casual bebop down Hazard Street, which was an inspiration to Phil Torres, because you know what? Someone's got to do these jobs, right?
I think it's in his original paper, Bostrom notes that the number of papers published about dung beetles in scholarly journals far exceeds the number about like human extinction or, you know.
No.
Yeah. So
that's
starting to change a little bit. Maybe this brings us right back to the two Phil Torreses.
I know.
So
speaking of like a double-sided coin.
Bridging this entomology and eschatology divide, though, one published paper titled The Role of Dung Beetles in Reducing Greenhouse Gas Emissions from Cattle Farming. So dung beetles, they're out there making the most of an objectively shitty situation, and they're helping us survive along the way.
Climate change is a phenomenon we've never encountered before, at least not this type of, you know, anthropogenic climate change, which is very rapid. There's also global biodiversity loss, which is truly extraordinary. It's widely considered that we're in the early stage of the sixth mass extinction event right now.
Oh, God.
And just to give listeners a sense of how dire the situation is with respect to the global ecosystems and the biosphere more generally, there was a report from 2014 called the Living Planet Report. And they found that between, I don't know, I'm chuckling, but no, they, it's just,
oh God,
I don't know what here the other comes. Options. Between 1970 and 2012, the global population of wild vertebrates declined by 58%.
Oh, that's a lot.
It's a huge amount.
That's a lot.
It's deeply unsettling. I mean, it's not difficult to extrapolate that into the future.
Right.
This is happening. It's urgent.
This is like the part in a party where shit starts going wrong. Like someone barfs, someone breaks the coffee table. It's getting late. The neighbors call the police and it's just like, oh, this party is done. Yeah. This party's done. We got to get out of here. Have you considered writing a book just called We're All Fucked? You would move so many copies. Just have it be called We're Fucked. I mean, that's kind of the reality, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I do think there's hope.
Wow. Okay. Let's run down. Let's say you're at a dinner party and someone's like, oh, what do you do? And you tell them and they're like, what, how's the world going to end? Give me a quick menu. If we had sat down at a restaurant and we're like, here are the options for apocalypse. What are we looking at?
Yeah. I sort of identify three main classes of phenomena. So the first class, I think, is environmental degradation.
Okay.
Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos want to, you know, to set up colonies on Mars, which is, I think, misguided. And all that money would be a lot better spent trying to ensure that this spaceship that we're on, it remains habitable. So yeah, there are all sorts of statistics that could be mentioned here that are very unsettling.
Okay.
And very worrisome.
Give me some. By the way, I'm with you on the, wait, why are we going to go to Mars when we have a planet that we're not done ruining yet?
Yeah.
We have a whole planet here. We could just not mess this up.
Yeah.
So give me some unsettling statistics. I'm ready for them.
I'm also very skeptical of space colonization, just generally. And there's a really fantastic book that's forthcoming by a guy named Daniel Dewdney, who's a political scientist at Johns Hopkins. Called Dark Skies, which offers a really detailed case for why venturing into the solar system and then into the galaxy could actually have quite ruinous consequences. The evolutionary trajectories that we will likely follow is in all sorts of technologies that we could use to alter our phenotypes.
You gotta just splice us together with a tardigrade. You know what I mean? Yeah. Half human, half tardigrade. My head on a tardigrade body, but the size of a dog. Yeah. I mean, that's what we're looking at. Withstand dehydration for 10 years. It'd be great. Can you imagine? I'm gonna Photoshop that.
So, awesome. I'm sorry to veer off in that direction, but space colonization is, I mean, that's another issue that is, you know, right now. I mean, it could be the next 10 years that we have some colonies on Mars. So like, yeah, I think it's a timely issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So getting back to the main potential causes of our annihilation.
Yeah. It sucks. I love it. It sucks so bad. We're all going to die. Okay. So we got environmental degradation.
Yeah. This is exactly the moment when we need environmental wisdom.
Oh. You know?
And we clearly don't have it. So the other issue, I think, it has to do with emerging technologies that are dual use in nature, can be used for both harmful or beneficial ends. There are various domains of technology right now that are developing extremely rapidly, at exponential pace or like super exponential pace. And they hold immense promises to cure disease, to reverse aging, to maybe even restore the environment in some way. I mean, de-extinction is like a new thing. You
know, like, I didn't know that was even a word.
That's a word. Yep.
It's very optimistic.
Yeah. George Church at Harvard is right now working on a project to bring back the woolly mammoth and some other species. So,
is that a good idea?
Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe not. Yeah. But I think there's a very good conversation to be had about that.
The conversation's being, is it ethical to edit Asian elephant genes and add in woolly mammoth traits? And does this lead the way to careless extinctions? Because now we know we have these genetic backups on ice. And also, was Mr. Snuffleupagus, the once selectively seen and then fully acknowledged mammoth-like puppet of Sesame Street, was he an agent of existential foreshadowing in this life simulation we call Earth? Also, is technology evil?
Technology could enable us to do all sorts of, I think, genuinely marvelous things. But also these same technologies could enable us to synthesize designer pathogens that, are really unnaturally dangerous. They could have long incubation periods, so you don't, you know, they could spread around the globe without people exhibiting symptoms, super lethal. And making matters worse, it's not only the case that the technology is becoming more powerful, but it's becoming much more accessible too. So it's not just that, like, a large group of scientists, like the Manhattan Project size group of experts, are able to create a pathogen that is, you know, exceptionally lethal. But, you know, small groups, little small terrorist groups, maybe even single individuals.
So you could DIY CRISPR the plague.
Yeah, don't say it so loudly, though.
No, never mind. Don't do that. Also, I hope our phones are eavesdropping.
It is a fact in researching books and papers that I have an internet history.
I bet you're on so many watch lists.
Looking up
some
really, really frightening pathogens.
I mean, I Google a lot about like whale dicks and stuff for this podcast, but your search history is going to be way more suspicious than mine, for sure.
No doubt.
So we're looking at essentially, we're screwing up the planet itself, and mm-hmm. and a lot of species are going extinct. Mm-hmm. Technology is moving so fast, it can be used probably more for bad than for good, or at least one could outpace the other.
As two philosophers, Julian Savulescu and Ingmar Persson, who've written a bunch of papers together, have pointed out, it tends to be a fact that it's just easier to do harm than to do good.
You know what? Settle in right now. Get cozy for something that will haunt the rest of your waking hours. Oh,
you know, it's easier to harm 100 people than to, you know, benefit them to the same degree. So I think technology is just kind of a big magnifying glass and is just, it is genuinely like a qualitatively new situation when like a single individual has the power to wreak, you know, civilizational havoc. These technologies seem to be empowering individuals much more than the state. You know, there's a book about this exact issue called The Future of Violence, and they talk about they conjecture that there may be an impending dissolution of the social contract, and with it, a kind of return to Hobbesian anarchy, where there's just no security. You know, the state is no longer able to provide security because single individuals can harm huge numbers of people in ways that are really difficult to detect and also are difficult to prevent.
P.S. Thomas Hobbes was a philosopher from the 1600s, and he held the core belief that human beings are just selfish creatures.
Mine. That's the idea behind the at least the Hobbesian version of social contract.
Is this also the logic behind doomsday bunkers, where you just like you get a bunch of dehydrated potatoes and you just like hit the underground?
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, you're just like a piece. You all fight it out up there. Yeah, I'm gonna live in this bunker.
I haven't gotten to that point yet myself.
Okay,
but I have been tempted at times just to stash a couple extra bottles of wine or something, just in case.
Some swords, maybe.
Yeah.
So this is like if you have 1 million pretty chill people, you just need one who will off the other million. Is that kind of what we're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or you could look at it from a different perspective and say, imagine you have, out of a population of 7.6 billion, you've got 1 million malicious agents who have omnicidal tendencies and would actually like to destroy humanity if they could. This is, by the way, a topic I've also written about, and there are those people out there, sure.
I've never heard the word omnicidal, but like...
Yeah, it's a lovely term.
They're like, this is my personal brand. Yeah. I'm really into omnicide.
It's a fun fact. Omnicidal means kill everything and everyone until the extinction of our species. It's very OTT, very over the top, very extra, very diva, very drama. Needs to just not.
So you can imagine like 1 million genuinely malicious agents and then ask like, what is the probability that any one of them will gain access to the relevant technology, which increasingly that's possible. You know, to set up a biohacker lab, you know, you only need a few hundred bucks.
Oh, pardon my despair grunting.
John Sotos hypothesizes that this distribution of unprecedented destructive capabilities could constitute a great filter that explains some probability bottleneck that all civilizations have to go through. And almost none of them make it out. Well, that's why we don't observe aliens wandering through the universe. The universe seems to be vacant in terms of, with respect to life.
So they all have like teenage gamers trying to kill each other, and they're on their own planet, and they're like, beep, bork, bork, nadork, and then they all die also. Oh, God.
Yes, you really should have co-authored it, because that would have been a nice flair at some point.
Just alien incels with 12 dicks being like, I can't even get laid at all. I'm going to kill everyone. Holy smokes. Okay, yeah. So
the last one, sorry for delaying.
I have too many questions. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no, it's fine. The last one I mentioned before that is a bit more speculative, but I would say it's machine superintelligence.
Oh, boy. We're talking AIs.
AI.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
We got some artificial intelligence that's going to kill us all.
Yeah, so one of the biggest myths is that the AI system that is dangerous is one that has some kind of malicious, malevolent, malign intentions. And while it's possible that a super intelligent machine could be designed in such a way, or could for some reason acquire a kind of must kill humans value system.
I love, by the way, that if there's a malicious AI, it can kill us all, but it can't make a complete sentence. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. It can't say,
great to make your acquaintance, I must kill all of the humans in existence.
It can only use an economy of words that's like,
yeah,
very simple, but it's very sophisticated in that it could kill us all. Can't learn the language. So must kill humans.
Yeah. Yeah. And the voice too.
Of course.
The better synthesized voices by the time. So the real danger is that it exceeds us. It exceeds the best possible that any member of our species could possibly achieve. And also that its value system is not sufficiently well aligned with ours. It makes for a much less compelling movie storyline. But this is actually the real substantive concern that people have. You know, computers tend to process information way faster than humans, a million plus times as fast. Basically, the outside world to it looks frozen.
Mm. And that's not even without, that's even without quantum computing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm just talking,
You're just talking about what we got, which compared to quantum computing is so slow.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Quantum computing, by the by, relies on an atom's superposition of being essentially two things at once, instead of our current computers, which rely on transistors to make bits that represent ones and zeros. Anyway, that's as nutshell as it gets, and probably a little bit wrong. But how much faster is quantum computing? Some say 100 million times faster than your laptop. It's a lot.
And so I like ran the numbers. I think the average PhD program in the US is like something like 8.2 years. And that if a computer's process information a million times faster, that means that super intelligent machine, or just a generally artificial general intelligence, could earn a PhD in something like 4.3 minutes or something. No. So
how much cheaper?
Yeah. So that's on the one hand. Second, there's something called the instrumental convergence thesis. Mm-hmm. And this is just the idea that for a wide range of final goals, there are some very predictable intermediary goals that the system is going to pursue.
So essentially, if you have goals, there are some basic things that you have to do to achieve them. Like if you wanted to be a musician, Phil says, you would have to get good at, say, shredding on guitar. You would have to obtain the guitar. And if your stepdad tried to kill your dreams, you would resist him and tell him, fuck you, Doug. No one likes your coleslaw or your mustache. And then you'd keep practicing those hot licks. Same with AI.
It's going to, first of all, it might look around and think, you know, these humans, they could try to shut me down. Mm-hmm. So it's maybe in my interest to eliminate them.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Another thing is, you know, humans are made out of conveniently located atoms.
Oh.
So it's as one researcher famously put it, Eliezer Yudkowsky, you know, it's not, to paraphrase him, it's not that the AI hates you or loves you. It just notices that you're made out of material that it can use for something else. So kind of the analogy here, this is another kind of, it's becoming a cliche a bit, is, you know, when humans go, you know, raise a forest to build a suburban neighborhood, you know, the result is sometimes like a, you know, pretty devastating ant genocide. And it's not that we have any ill will toward, it's not that we're malevolent towards the ants. It's simply that we're much smarter and therefore can manipulate the world in ways that the ants can't even conceive. And also we just have different values. Our value systems are not properly aligned. So if you think about this analogy, you know, with us as the ants going about our business, we have our own values. We want to build these little colonies underground. And then the super intelligent system that we create ends up having values that don't perfectly align with our colony building values. Then, you know, it may just raise the forest and in pursuit of its own, you know, particular aims with the consequence being that we all perish.
And the next thing you know, we fucked. You went, once again, come to the conclusion, end of the flowchart, we're fucked.
Yeah, that reminds me a lot of, there was a, I think I'm probably going to forget the guy's name, but there was a geophysicist, Brad Werner, I think is his name. He presented, gave a presentation that was titled, Is Earth Fucked? And he got a fair amount of press for it. And as he explained to someone, I think from like Gizmodo or something, that his answer is more or less. Yeah.
It's just a shrug.
Yeah.
A single slide. Yep. You're like, wow, that was a 45 second presentation. He's done. He's like, and there's croissants in the lobby. So bye bye. Now, how do you think the world is going to end? If you had to put your money on it. Not that money matters when the apocalypse is nigh, but if someone's like, Mr. Torres,
yeah,
put your money on the end. What is it?
I think it would be imprudent to specify one particular scenario.
You're like all of them.
I have yet to discover a particularly good counterargument to the issue that we were talking about before.
So in regard to the democratization of destructive technology, that little thing.
If there is a technology, you know, as some people have said, if everybody around the world had an app on their phone that where they could open it up and push a button that would destroy the world, who thinks the world would last for more than 2 seconds?
Oh, it would be over. There would be someone who got rejected for a prom date. Oh, we'd be smoked.
Yeah, it's implausible to think we would last for a minute.
And it would, I'm sorry, but it would 1,000,000% be a dude between the ages of like 16 and 23 that did it. Like 100%. Someone's prom date, someone's girlfriend left them for someone who does more CrossFit, and then the world is over. That's how it would end. No offense.
This is another topic that has been discussed among the relevant scholars. Basically, the argument is that, you know, a milieu in which there are extremely powerful technologies, and then there's this segment of humanity that is suffering from testosterone poisoning, and I've written about this as well. I'm very worried about it.
What can we do for the dudes? Like, if the dude were a stray animal, mm-hmm. let's say a wounded raccoon. Yeah. Or a neglected rabid dog. What could we do to help fix them so they don't kill us in the face?
I don't have a good answer. I mentioned before the philosophers Julian Savulescu and Ingmar Persson, who wrote a really interesting book from 2012 called Unfit for the Future, where they talked about they go into immense detail about the possibility of using moral bioenhancements.
Moral bioenhancements. These are a thing. I feel like coffee is already kind of one of them.
These would be biomedical interventions that would aim to enhance our empathy, sympathetic concern. And it's really controversial. It's person engineering type stuff. But they argue on the one hand that if we remain as we are, moving into the future, the outcome's going to be bad. We're fucked.
We're fucked. Yeah.
That is what warrants. I believe they would say they're considering a possibility that's really quite radical. Anyways, the point is that, you know, statistically speaking, women tend to do better than men with respect to empathy. And sympathy and you know, moral characteristics like that. So they have this really great line where they say, you know, what may need to happen is that we make men more like women, or rather, men more like men who are like women. There are definitely people in this field who take seriously the potentially quite combustible mixture of, you know, just toxic masculinity and dual use technologies.
That's like a toddler with a machine gun, kind of.
I don't know what to say. Maybe put the men on Mars or something. You just sequester them over there, and then
oxytocin supplements, maybe?
Oxytocin is one of the main possibilities that Savulescu and Persson discuss. But unfortunately, oxytocin, the effects are limited to racial in-groups, according to a whole bunch of studies. So you do get more empathetic to other humans, but it doesn't go beyond your race, at least in the studies.
Oh, jeez. The hugest problem we have, pretty much.
Yeah, so they do mention at some point that this is, let's say, not a trivial problem with... You know, because I mean, we have fluoride in the public drinking water, you know, for healthier dentition. And
we vaccinate.
So there's a kind of perspective where, I don't know, maybe it's not totally crazy that you'd put some oxytocin in the, you know, in the public drinking water.
The Mountain Dew. Just put it in the Monster Energy, because I feel like those are the people who need it.
I really like the more targeted approach. That's much more clever.
How often do you think about the apocalypse? Is it only when you're working, or is it when you're driving around, when a new Mariah Carey single drops, when you are...
Is there a new single?
I don't know.
Okay.
A girl can dream. I'm trying to think of the good things in life.
As fate, and I guess the subconscious effect that a good publicist would have, Mariah Carey does have a new album coming out. It drops November 16th, people, and fittingly for this episode, it's titled Caution. Also, does Phil ever get bummed?
But, like, do you think about it on a daily basis? Like, maybe I shouldn't sweat this because we're about to annihilate the planet.
So, if you take seriously some of the probability estimates that scholars have proposed, Bostrom has a few. Toby Ord, you know, has suggested that we maybe have a 1 in 6 chance of surviving the century.
1 in 6 chance of surviving the next 82 years.
Yeah.
Are you going to have kids? Do you have kids?
No.
Okay. Are you going to have kids?
No.
Do you think, or is that because you're like, we're all going to die anyway? Because I've often thought that. I'm like, yeah. Number one, there's too many of us. We're growing exponentially. No one needs more of me.
Yeah.
One of me is plenty. And also,
yeah, one of me is enough for the world.
And then they're just going to die. But how do you approach those kind of life decisions?
There's a philosophical component and then like a kind of empirical component. Empirically, I think I could imagine a version of the world that is worth living in. You know, we're like, people take science seriously. You know, it could be the case that climate change is right now not a concern at all because people listened to scientists back in the 90s, et cetera, and then took actions just like we did with the ozone hole. Yeah, there's a sense in which the world could be significantly more livable than it is. Unfortunately, we're in a world, you know, where I mean, I can only assume what your personal politics are, but you know, Donald Trump is got elected even after the Trump tape and, you know, et cetera. I mean, that's an unfortunate world, to put it crudely, it's a shitty world. Mm-hmm. So I'm and maybe another way to put this is I'm deeply disappointed in my species for not doing better. But so then there's a philosophical issue, and this gets to an idea referred to as antinatalism.
Oh, okay. Oh, there's a word for it?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was just spinsterism. It was just old weird aunt with no kids-ism. I didn't know there was an antinatalism.
Yeah, so it's a pretty fascinating view. It's like Arthur Schopenhauer is kind of famously an antinatalist who believed, and his argument was that life is just terrible. You know, life is dukkha.
So dukkha translates from the Sanskrit and it means suffering, pain, or stress. So life is dukkha is a Buddhist phrase that means that life is kind of unsatisfactory and painful. Life just kind of sucks. Now, in all transparency, when Phil said life is dukkha, I thought he meant dookie, which is a casual term for poo. But he also said that some argue that the most compassionate thing you can do is not bring a child into the world because it's hard. It's just hard to live. It's hard to be a person. But a lot of this probably depends on your own outlook on life and how much you enjoy it. I do not enjoy most Italian food, to a lot of people's shock and disgust of me. But ergo, I would never bring someone to Buca di Beppo as a treat. However, some people love it. They would definitely invite others to a spaghetti fest. Now, from an evolutionary standpoint, some scientists think it's better for a species not to fully grasp the pain of existence.
Thomas Metzinger, another philosopher, has talked about how, you know, evolutionarily speaking, we probably would not have been selected. Tendencies to recognize the extent of harm in our life, those tendencies would be selected against. Because that's not really good for,
right?
You know, for getting it on.
Right. You know? You're like, this is terrible. Let's make more of us.
Yeah, exactly. So he says it's always a harm to bring a human into the world because yeah, because you're all that humans, sure, they're going to have some good experiences, but they're also going to have bad experiences, whereas a person who doesn't exist isn't going to miss those good experiences, but is, you know, it is good that individual is not experiencing the bad stuff.
If you had a time frame that you thought the apocalypse maybe were to visit us,
yeah,
kind of like a doom fairy, when do you think that might happen? I'm just trying to figure out, like, do I buy the extra protection plan with the electronics? How much do I invest in my retirement?
This is a general issue that we've returned to several times.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's fine. I just don't have a good sense. Objectively, I mean, you can, you know, we know that, you know, a huge asteroid that could kill our species strikes Earth every, you know, 400 million years or something, or 400,000 years maybe. A supervolcano erupts every 50,000 or so. the last one, well, two supervolcanic eruptions ago was the Toba catastrophe that might have resulted in a population bottleneck of maybe 1,000 humans. So we almost went extinct.
Oh,
way back
so
when.
Close. Those 1,000 must have been so horny. Yeah. Oh, they must have been like, you guys, we got work to do. So, I mean, we could have Yellowstone could just pop off and then there could be 12 of us left.
That is a frightening possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Toba catastrophe theory, just looked it up, it holds that 75,000 years ago in Indonesia, there was a volcano so wicked that it led to a volcanic winter that lasted 6 to 10 years and maybe a 1,000-year-long cooling episode for the Earth. And we all almost died. Now, for more on volcano doom, if you're like, wow, didn't know I was so horny for volcano facts, see episode 1 with Jess Phoenix, You Will Lava It.
Bostrom puts the probability at least 20% based on objective and subjective considerations. That is before 2100. Martin Rees suggests that there's a 50-50 chance of civilizational collapse this century. If you take seriously some of these estimates and you compare them to the likelihood of dying, for example, in a car accident or a plane accident or something of that sort, it turns out you're much more likely to encounter some kind of human extinction event than...
Really?
Like thousands of times more likely.
Wow.
I should add quickly, you're also much more likely to die in like a huge asteroid strike than get struck by lightning or something. And that's just because an asteroid strike is going to harm so many people that if you consider the probability over, you know, millennia, then that's how you get the probability that you're more likely to die that way.
Oh, but it's still numbers are numbers. I'll take it.
Yeah.
Do you live your life differently thinking about the apocalypse, or do you give advice to anyone like, we should still be recycling, right?
We should, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We should still be helping fellow humans.
Oh, very much so.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Trying not to squash any endangered species.
Mm-hmm.
Vote for people who give at least one shit about the future. Right?
Yeah.
And don't develop AI that could use human atoms as fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever watched Black Mirror?
Yes.
How do you feel about it?
Very good.
Good?
Yeah.
Why?
I mean...
Sorry, I'm screaming.
Let me change my answer a bit. I think the show is fantastic.
Okay.
I think a lot of the topics that the show explores are really fascinating, and it's a lot of these issues are kind of right around the corner. So it's giving us a sneak peek, in certain respects at least, of kind of near term. You know, issues with social media, with, you know, but possibly things like mind uploading. I mean, that might be, you know, in the next, you know, several decades. It's really quite good. And I think it's helpful to explore the more dystopian possibilities. Because again, you know, these technologies are dual use. They don't just have destructive capabilities, but also on the other hand, they could really ameliorate the human condition in all sorts of amazing ways. I certainly would be elated if we could cure all disease, you know.
To be dope as hell.
And cancer, Alzheimer's, and focusing on the peril, I think, doesn't make one a pessimist. This is an issue that I've had with a lot of Steven Pinker's work, because he seems to think that people who talk about existential risks are pessimistic. Like, you know, I tend to be fairly optimistic in my personal life by my nature, but there are some facts about the world that make me pessimistic.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, the point is, in order to increase the chance that there is actually a really good outcome, it's critical to focus on the worst case scenarios, on how things could go wrong, where you say, okay, let's fix this outcome. In fact, Pinker has accused some existential risk scholars of just kind of sitting around trying to invent new doomsday scenarios. Well, Kind of, yes. Because sure. Because we certainly don't want to be blindsided.
We got these big old noggins. We got to use them. You think ahead. I'd like to rely on the theory that this is all a simulation. Possibilities that that's true?
It's possible.
Okay. Like, can you just say that it's possible? If it were a simulation, if someone were like, hey, got news, would you do anything differently in your life?
Probably not.
But some scholars, he says, like Max Tegmark, have simulation theories, maybe a little tongue-in-cheek, that maybe the more strife and jerks in power and religious wars we have, the more entertaining we are to the folks running the simulation. Kind of like an ant farm with a lot of battles and activities, only we're people, and it feels real, and it hurts, and we want to sleep all the time to escape the pain.
Can I ask you some Patreon questions if I make it quick?
Yeah.
I'm going to lob a couple questions at you at random.
Okay.
Okay, so on Patreon, patrons get to submit questions. And I'm just going to ask you a few at total random. A lot of people all were just like, how are we going out? That's like everyone's. Would it be self-induced or extraterrestrial? Everyone's like, how are we going out? Everyone wants to know.
But before we take questions from you, our beloved listeners, we're going to take a quick break for sponsors of the show. Sponsors? Why sponsors? You know what they do? They help us give money to different charities every week. So if you want to know where Ologies gives our money, you can go to alleyward.com and look for the tab Ologies Gives Back. There's like 150 different charities that we've given to already, with more every single week. So if you need a place to go donate a little bit of money, but you're not sure where to go, those are all picked by ologists who work in those fields. And this ad break allows us to give a ton of money to them. So thanks for listening and thanks, sponsors.
Hi, I'm the person whose closet is put in color order, but I'll also pick up an earthworm without thinking twice. In fact, I did yesterday. It needed my help. I'm not afraid to be a little messy. Human nature is messy, but nature can help us embrace it. I love the brand Seventh Generation. Their laundry detergent lifts away tough stains with the power of bioenzymes. That's exciting. You wipe your hands on your pants after you pick up an earthworm? Seventh Generation is like, don't worry. Hug a dirty tree. Huff some bark. It's good for you. That is the power of Seventh Generation. Find laundry detergent and other laundry products at seventhgeneration.com. I love worms. Oh, hi, it's me, the lady that checks a bunch of scholarly articles before she believes anything, Allie Ward. And I feel like we are similar in that we have a fair amount of skepticism and we like to dive deep and find out what the actual facts are. This is why when it comes to any kind of supplements, I enjoy Ritual, which is a female-founded B Corp, meaning that they're holding themselves accountable to not just the company, but also to the health of people in our planet. And their clinically backed Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin has these high-quality, traceable key ingredients in bioavailable forms that are clean. Only about 1% of supplement brands are USP verified, and Ritual is one of them. So I like being able to trust what I'm putting in my body. From an aesthetic standpoint, I'll also tell you that Ritual are beautiful little vitamins. They look like lava lamps and they taste like mint. So taking my Ritual is part of my, I guess, morning ritual. That's probably why they named it that and I didn't even think about it. Anyway, no more shady business. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus is a multivitamin you can actually trust. So get 25% off your first month at ritual.com/ologies. You can start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18 Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/ologies for 25% off. Down the hatch.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Okay, your questions. Kira Lichtenfeld asked, do you put any stock into the doomsday clock? She also notes that was an accidental rhyme. And P.S., the doomsday clock is a symbol that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists first employed in 1947. It represents how close we are to a man-made global catastrophe. Now, should I change man-made to person-made, or should I just leave it man-made? I'm going to leave it. Also, how close we are to climate change or a global nuclear war. Now, doomsday is represented by midnight, and in 1947, it was set to 7 minutes to the hour. Now, it's been set backwards and forwards 23 times since then, and it reached a placid 17 minutes to the hour in 1991, but it has changed recently.
Donald Trump, I'm sure you know this, or listeners know this, but he more or less single-handedly pushed the doomsday clock, the minute hand of the doomsday clock forward.
Oh, God.
That happened in 2017. They announced almost January or something, and then that was the clock went from 3 minutes before midnight, which represents doom, to 2.5 minutes. And then earlier this year, I should say, it was pushed forward another 30 seconds.
Oh, dear.
Almost entirely because of Trump's actions and, you know, climate denialism, and background, you know, also like withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement and the Iran nuclear deal.
Oh, my God.
Both of which the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which runs the Doomsday Clock, identified previously as they put it, two bright spots in front of a canopy of bleakness. Or they had some kind of something somewhat dark and dismally poetic. So there is...
We're, you know, just inching closer.
At exactly the moment in human history, you know, we've been around for 200,000 years and recorded history started maybe 4,000 years ago, 6,000 years ago, I guess. And as Stephen Hawking said in an Guardian op-ed in 2016, I think, there's very good reason for thinking this is the most dangerous moment in all of human history. So at this critical juncture in our career as a species, exactly the moment when we need someone who is deeply sagacious and wise and thoughtful and understands our evolving existential predicament, we have someone who is, I mean, I know I'm not, this isn't a bold original thesis that I'm proposing here, but someone who is just profoundly ignorant and just revels in ignorance and foolishness and myopia.
Aaron Estabrooks wants to know, are we better off heading for water or going underground?
Are those the only two options?
I don't know. I think she's assuming that we want to survive.
Yeah.
Just dark.
Well, some scholars have advocated for bunkers that are continually occupied.
If you're cruising Redfin for an apocalypse pied de terre, there's a former missile silo near Topeka for sale. Just over $3 million, 34 acres, solar panels, comes with a lawnmower, and 11,000 square feet of hunker-down fun-time space below the earth. Perhaps you can invite Michael Stipe for a slumber party.
So that's one option. Water, I don't know. I mean, actually, submarines could serve the exact same purpose as bunkers.
Oh.
You know, there could be some global catastrophe. Some scenarios, it actually wouldn't be effective. Of course, like a runaway greenhouse effect, or, you know, there could be a physics disaster that results in a black hole or strange lit or a vacuum bubble, as it's called, that could actually destroy the entire universe.
Oh, dear.
That seems unlikely, but also possible. I mean, Mars sounds as appealing as underground or underwater to me. And Mars doesn't sound too appealing.
It does not sound very appealing. It seems very dry there. Jessica Vitarelli wants to know, why are humans so obsessed with being judged at the end of their life? Is it something learned or just part of our makeup?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
Surely some of it is learned. I mean, this is outside my area of expertise, so I'm just guessing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no doubt some of it's learned, but also, I don't know, my immediate thought is like maybe there's a component of morality that leads us to wish that when we're gone, you know, that during our lives we would have had a positive impact and left some kind of trace that, you know, benefited the world or just the people around us, you know.
That's a kind, nice answer.
It's the best I could do.
No, it's you managed it. Shelby Fawn wants to know, how has studying neuroscience informed your philosophical work? And what is your favorite weird end of the world potentiality? So neuroscience and philosophy.
Yeah.
And then what's the best way to go out?
Yeah. So the reason I was interested in neuroscience to begin with was because I was focusing as an undergrad on philosophy of mind. And this was kind of shortly after Patricia Churchland published her book on neurophilosophy. And she holds a view about folk psychology, beliefs, desires.
Okay, so this is a philosophy in a very, very tiny, tiny thumbnail nutshell asserts that things we think we understand up in the mind, like that we believe in things or desire things, not really real because they're poorly defined and that behavior should just be judged on biological levels.
So I was pretty intrigued by that, and I thought maybe it would be worth learning a bit more about the hardware, you know, and seeing how that might inform philosophizing about the wetware, you know, the higher level of conscious experience or you know, just cognitive functions.
And then what's your favorite apocalypse scenario?
Okay, so there's this amazing polymathic scholar at Oxford University named Anders Sandberg, and he recently responded to a Quora question, which was, what would happen if the Earth suddenly turned into high-density blueberries? And he took the question seriously and did the math and ended up responding with a paper that is up on archive. And it's a really technical, fantastic, sophisticated article that I couldn't get through parts of it, but it was really quite entertaining. And so I think that's my most favorite fantastical eschatological scenario.
I'm ready for the blueberry death.
You're blowing up like a balloon.
Like a blueberry.
Yeah.
I'm so ready for it. Lindsay Frischmuth wants to know, number one, are you familiar with Harry Potter?
Not really.
Okay. She wanted to know if you're Slytherin, but something told her that you're a Ravenclaw. There are different houses. Maybe you could go take that. Who knows? But my last two questions.
Yeah.
Worst thing about your job. What sucks about studying the apocalypse? That's such a broad question. But yeah. What is the worst thing about studying the apocalypse?
Yeah. Well, it's not the most soporific topic. That's for sure.
Okay. Soporific just means inducing drowsiness. So no, the end of the world, not a sleepy business. Also, yes, I looked it up.
I do enjoy. I mean, it's meaningful. Work for sure. I think that's what enables me to spend days, you know, just really cogitating some particular, dark scenario.
Cogitate, to think about or meditate upon. Toss that in your little word toolbox. It's a good one.
I don't know in terms of downsides. I mean, it's hard to get grants, you know, it's... that's a bit of a struggle. I think that's the worst part.
Getting grants?
Yeah, getting grants.
I love that you study heat death of the universe, starvation, extinction, and the worst is applying for grants. That's the darkest part. Because do you ever just get a stamp back that's like big stamp, like boom, well, what's the point? I was like, you've convinced me in your grant that the apocalypse is coming. Ergo, I will not fund it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I imagine there are some studies, some papers that could be written that, you know, might present a really compelling case that that the end is imminent. And that would deter, no doubt,
yeah,
the garnering of further money.
They're like, we're going to take this money. We're going to buy a yacht. We're going to throw a party instead because it's all coming. What's the best thing about your job? What do you love the most about being an eschatologist?
I think it's what I gestured at a moment ago. I find it really meaningful. And this gets back even to the sort of, to use the term a bit loosely, the kind of paradox of the field, how it's extremely important topic, whose importance is, as I said before, is just very parasitic on the importance of all other things, you know, poetry and sports and literature and so on. It is meaningful. I mean, it's, you know, this is work that aims to improve the lives of the next generation, and also to ensure that the great experiment called civilization continues, and this multi-generational project of science and philosophy and so on can perhaps reach some kind of, you know, there'll be a good ending to the narrative of human existence. So yeah, that's, I find that deeply satisfying. If you're a young person and you happen to also care about human survival, then, this is a good field to go into. It's a growth field also, as colleagues say. It's not going away anywhere anytime soon.
There's never been a better time to be a doomsdayer.
Awesome. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
To find more of the brilliant and delightful Phil Torres' work, you can see the website riskandreligion.org. He is ex-riskology on Twitter. I'll link those both in the show notes. And his books are The End, What Science and Religion Tells Us About the Apocalypse, and last year's release, Morality, Foresight, and Human Flourishing, An Introduction to Existential Risks. So do get your mitts on those. Ologies is at Ologies on Twitter and Instagram. I'm Allie Ward with one L on both, so do follow along. Ologiesmerch.com has shirts that you can maybe use as a tourniquet during the chaos of an extraterrestrial alien invasion. Thank you, Bonnie Dutch and Shannon Feltis. And the Ologies podcast Facebook group is great. Wonderful people, new friends you can meet before we all die. Thank you, Aaron Talbert and Hannah Lippo, for admining. Nick Thorburn wrote and performed the theme music for this. He is in a band called Islands. And this was edited by lifesaver Stephen Ray Morris, who also hosts the podcasts The Purrcast and See Jurassic Right. Now, if you stick around to the end, you know I tell you a secret every episode. So this week's secret is that right before I started recording these asides, I got a text from my dad on the family thread about how there were 39 earthquakes on the San Andreas Fault yesterday. That's great. It starts with an earthquake. So that's scary. But my first reaction to that was like, well, no one would expect you to return emails for a few days, so that'd be pretty sweet. And then also, it's not as bad as an asteroid. So maybe this apocalypse stuff is uplifting. Maybe we should laugh about it just a little more and live life in a way that's like, eh, fuck it. Cut bangs, sing some karaoke, dance in a park, just do your thing. It's all gonna end. Okay, bye-bye.
Pachydermatology, homeology, cryptozoology, lithology, nanotechnology, meteorology,
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.